kind of guys who'd make you feel like that. Oh no!
Hello and welcome to episode number 107 of Today in Digital Education, the Tide Podcast, with me, Di Barnes, and
me, Doug Belshaw. Di, it seems like ages since I did a podcast. I've been all over Europe.
Yeah, I've been to Europe, but not all over it, I have to say. But I've flown back from America too. I'm now sitting safely back at home. How about you?
Well, I'm back in my man cave. You've been, I think last weekend we were not too far apart. So I think I probably got the train through Munich while you were there.
Really? Well, that's an exciting thing. Hi, Doug. I waved at you. Did you not see? So I spent the last weekend in Munich with a couple of friends of mine, Arnold and Paul, whom I taught with, 20 years ago, maybe. People who listen to Tide regularly will know that last year we went to Madrid, the year before that. Oh, no, we went to Wroclaw last year in Poland, Madrid the year before, Saumur in France the year before that. And then this year we decided to go to Munich and had a fantastic time. What a great city. Really interesting. We went deliberately to take in Saturday night rather than go midweek where it's cheaper, and had a stonking night out. Left the nightclub at 5 o'clock in the morning. Hello.
Wow.
Middle-aged old men, but didn't really feel like it. It was all good.
I don't think I've ever left a nightclub at 5 a.m. 4 a.m. I think was my limit once.
Nightclubs are a thing of my youth, I'm afraid. So.
Well, on the way to the place where we flew back from last night, we're recording this on the evening of Wednesday, the 22nd of August. So last night, we got back about just before midnight. We flew back from Stuttgart via Heathrow. And Stuttgart, if you haven't been, don't bother. I would say we stayed in the Hilton Garden Inn next to VfB Stuttgart's stadium, which is the Mercedes-Benz Arena. And it's opposite where they do the Oktoberfest in Stuttgart. But unfortunately, it's kind of out of town a bit, which it makes it a bit awkward to get to.
Can you answer me a question about Oktoberfest? Is it in October?
It is, yeah. And actually, before Oktoberfest, they have the Volksfest, like a folk festival, which is very family friendly. So before they wheel in all the beer, they have like a family friendly festival in the same site.
All right. It starts on the 22nd of September and ends on the 7th of October, Oktoberfest.
Does it? All right. Okay. Shows what I know. Yeah. It might be different in different places. Who knows?
Okay. So Stuttgart, not so good.
No, Stuttgart was a bit rubbish, but it's funny, isn't it, how as humans we tend to focus on the negatives. And also, I've done lots of reading on the psychological effect of how things finish. So one of the things I really wanted to do was to make sure that the holiday finished on a bang. I'd done some research, bizarrely. Some of the things I've read about, you know, if people have an operation, they subjectively, when you do the testing, they'd rather have a harsher operation which then finishes in a bit more of a pleasant way than one where you're not as harsh all the way through, if that makes sense. So if the pain was like a 6 all the way through, they'd rather have something which was a 9 and then finished on a 4, if that makes any sense.
It does.
And so there's something about the way that things end. And I don't know if you've noticed, films these days tend to have a very good feel, like a feel-good thing at the end of the film to send you on your way. And so I thought, well, it's holiday. We need to do something like that. And so we kind of blew the rest of the budget on like a suite in the Hilton in Stuttgart. Unfortunately, after having no hassle the entire holiday, the air conditioning didn't work in that hotel room. They moved us and that still didn't work. And we had 2 nights of disturbed sleep before we came home. But the rest of the holiday was fantastic. And if you're listening to this and you've never been to Ljubljana, you've got to go. It's such an amazing place.
What was so good about it?
Well, I mean, we arrived in the rain and it was still our favorite place. We gave everyone what we wrote down our scores for each of the places at the end of the holiday and everyone gave it a 10. It's kind of, everyone speaks English. It's really set up for kind of like families, but also, you know, if you just want to go for not like a crazy night out, but like a good drinking, it's cheap. I don't know if I've mentioned this on the podcast, but Slovenia has the highest participation in sport of any European country in terms of its citizens. So and it's just a very friendly, lovely place. It's about 300,000 people, I think, and it's quite compact. And we got a bus to Lake Bled, which is if you search Lake Bled on kind of Flickr or Instagram or whatever, you'll see the magnificent photos. It's one of those. It's a lake, and you can cycle around it 6 kilometers, and it's got an island in the middle with this wonderful kind of church and then a castle on top of it, and you can swim in this extremely clear lake. I had such a good time, like, to the extent that we're just going to go back to Slovenia.
That looks cool. We're looking for somewhere to go in the same as the Munich holiday. We're looking for somewhere to go next year, so maybe maybe that's
you can fly direct from if you listen to this in the UK, you can fly direct from Stansted and Luton, and obviously get transfers via Amsterdam. So yeah, that's where we're going to go next year. We're going to go to Slovenia.
Cool. Lake Bled does look beautiful. I have just done as Doug instructed and done an image search on it, and it really does look divine.
It is fantastic.
In Munich, there was a park with a river running through it. So the English Garden, which is pronounced very similar in German, has this river running through, which you can float down. It's really fabulous. So and loads of people were doing it in their underwear because it was hot. You just whip your kit off and off you go. It's pretty cool.
Well, I had one of the reasons I wanted to go to Barcelona was Moodle has opened a new office there, I think I've mentioned before. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of priming the family for, like, oh, maybe we could move to Barcelona. I don't think that's going to happen. Like, they like Barcelona, but it's not, I don't think it's their kind of place to live particularly. So I think that's out the window. But Barcelona is great. Lyon was lovely. Lyon's fantastic. Not as good as Ljubljana, because you know what the French are like. They'll not willingly speak to you in English. Hilariously, I managed to speak entirely in French for an entire meal with in an Italian restaurant in Lyon, where they only spoke French, and they refused to speak me in English, including explaining that I was pescatarian, although I said I was vegetarian. I made a mistake on the pizza. And if you imagine this situation, my wife, who doesn't speak French, speaks some German, the kids, who don't speak any French, me doing all this stuff in, like, not very fluent French, but, you know, getting by and being understood nevertheless, and holding my own and not being, you know, drawing attention to myself. And the pizzas eventually come out. I mean, it was a very busy night, and the pizzas eventually come out after 45 minutes, an hour. And I've made a mistake on my order. And if you imagine a pizza laden with ham, like more ham, like comedy amounts of ham, like properly stacked high with ham, I would say. that's what came out. And the kids just fell about laughing, like, because they know that I don't eat meat. And I had to then explain in French that, like, I was vegetarian, I didn't eat this. The guy then in French started going through the menu and saying, well, what did you choose? And all this. So yeah, it tested me out a bit, especially when I'm learning Spanish on Duolingo. But I managed to do that in Lyon, and we went to Zurich. Have you been to Zurich, Di?
Long, long time ago.
It's an awful place and massively overpriced as well.
Well, it is certainly overpriced. I mean, yeah, Zurich, man.
Very unfriendly. And we went straight from there to Ljubljana, which is very cheap. And so we couldn't find anywhere reasonable to eat in Zurich. And, you know, we weren't skimping. We're staying in Airbnbs and nice hotels. And had this awful McDonald's just before we got on the train. And Ljubljana, the next night, we had like 3-course meal, alcohol, the lot, for not much more than the McDonald's. It was a different world.
Okay, that sounds like the kind of place I'd like to go. Mm. It's quite interesting, the Englishification of the world, as in language rather than culture. Mm. And so a lot of in Germany, a lot of people spoke English very, very well, and weirdly enough. But when we were looking up for places to go out, looking for a bar on the Sunday night, because it was a pretty quiet place on a Sunday, and there were places that would not allow English people in.
Really?
Yeah, it's quite interesting. No English. I guess that's I don't know. There's been some bad behavior in the past.
Well, I have to say, the only times we came across English people as opposed to, like, Americans or Canadians, it did make me feel a bit embarrassed to be British. Because either the people were speaking loudly, or like they just didn't have any etiquette, or yeah, it was a bit not great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's an interesting thing. Mm-hmm. We will see how the English language takes, well, continues to grow.
Oh, yeah, I mean, everywhere you go, there's things in English. People speak at least a little bit of English. It's, yeah, I'd really made an effort in France to only speak French to people. But I'm not that great. And then after Ljubljana, I went to Salzburg, which wasn't my choice. Hannah, my wife, wanted to, I don't know, relive the Sound of Music, I guess. But interestingly, like when I arrived, I was like, oh my goodness, this is the most boring place in the entire world. But then the next day we went to the water park, which was so, like, it wasn't served by public transport. So the only way you could get there was in a car. So it was only really local people. And we were the only English speaking people there, I think, or like native language speaking. And it was a fantastic water park. And then we went to this really interesting place, which had been the gardens or the house of the Archbishops of Salzburg. And they'd, in the 17th century, they invented these trick fountains, which, how can I explain? Everywhere you went in this garden, there was some kind of button that the person could press to kind of soak you in some way, like a table, a stone table all set out with a bit in the middle where you could cool your wine. But they could press a button underneath and it would soak all the guests. Or these little grottos with deer antlers, and then you press a button. It was almost like, it was almost like Dennis the Menace, but in an aristocratic 17th century style.
Cool. Sounds good.
And as you can imagine, the kids found it hilarious.
I bet they did.
And I got very wet.
Good.
But yeah, I'd definitely go into Rolling again. It was pretty cool.
I've never been. It was a thing that was talked about a lot when we were, well, certainly when I was younger, as a means of traveling, is get yourself an Interrailing ticket for a month around Europe. But I never did it. Gilly did it, my friend who I went to see in America. He enjoyed it.
Well, the only thing I'd say, if you listen to this and you think, oh, that sounds like something I want to do. Ironically, the best trains, I would say, are the Swiss ones, even though I didn't have the best of time in Switzerland. But the... if you get an Interrail ticket, so I think it was about £600-£700 for Hannah and I for the tickets, and the kids under 12 are free. So if you, my son's 11, my daughter's 7, so they were free, which is great. You know, my son won't be next year. But then on top of that, if you're in France or Spain, you have to you want to travel on the fast trains, which you definitely want to. You have to pay for a reservation on top of that, which is like another £110 a time. So yeah, it ended up being quite an expensive business. You have to know what you're doing.
I imagine it can be. I remember when I traveled on the train in France, that you have to pay something, even though you've bought your ticket, you have to pay something at the station. I don't know if it's the same sort of thing.
Yeah, like mandatory reservation kind of thing. And yes. The difference between second class and first class makes you think, oh, I might as well go first class. And then you think, oh, well, what am I actually going to get better? Just nicer seats. But if you're hesitant, definitely go with first class like we did, because you get access to the first class lounge, which means you can stock up on food and drinks and chill out in between.
It's all right. Okay. That makes a lot of sense. It's one thing I noticed about flying to America, actually, and airplanes generally now these days, obviously I travel as cheap as possible. So on the cheapest flights going. And they don't provide food for you unless you actually book it. And I didn't realize this. And I remember when I've been to America before, I did book it, but I forgot. But I didn't see anywhere obvious when I was booking my flights to just add food, because there's always the things like, if you've got a hotel, do you want to do this? Do you want to do that? Do you want to, you know, have a baby or something? So I just ignore everything, just get my ticket and roll on through. So anyway, I didn't get any food on the flight, and on the way out, that was 10 hours of I had to use the bar and buy it, but it was it's a bit strange. But everything's becoming very budgety. Although when I was on, did I say this? When I was on Frontier Airlines, which was a domestic flight in America, they said they were buying 180 planes by 2022. They were going to have 180 new planes. I thought, wowee, that's expansion. Right.
That is definitely expansion. Well, I mean, you know, what I found interesting was we know this, but like the different attitudes towards alcohol in Europe compared to the UK. Like for example, in the first class lounge in, where was it? Barcelona, you could just get as much alcohol as you want. That would never happen at like King's Cross or whatever. People would just be absolutely plastered. And then
I'm not sure why that is. The English and alcohol don't seem to do very well. No. I think I'm a very good drinker. I was going to say smoker then, which I am very good at as well. So if ever ever I meet anyone listening to this, I'm a very good drinker, just so you know. Very well, and I like
that. And in Germany, so unfortunately, Germany was very hot, going from Salzburg to Stuttgart. And the air conditioning was also broken in the compartment we were in. And so I was just wandering down the train and went down to the cafe area. It's all set up like a bar. And people are quaffing these huge, you know, things, not just like little bottles of beer, but these massive schooners of beer, you know, like you must have had in Munich.
Yeah.
And just having a great time without getting off their heads. And I thought, this is just a completely different world compared to England.
Yeah, I don't, I don't know. People, it's, I don't know. I don't know what it is, really. I tend to behave myself pretty well when I'm drunk. Who knows? Right, let's get on with this. Because you're hiring a back-end developer.
This is just me coming back today. So got back at midnight last night, straight into an 8 a.m. meeting with people in Perth, Australia, around internal branding for Moodle. But the things I've been catching up on today, some work that the technical architect Mael de Borneel has been working on, and we're hiring a back-end developer for MoodleNet. MoodleNet, if you remember, is going to be like a social network for educators, specifically integrated with Moodle as well. So this is advertised on Workable, and then it's stored on Workable, and it's advertised on LinkedIn and Stack Overflow and stuff. And if you're more technically minded listening to this, you might be interested in the fact that we're going to be using Elixir as a language for backend development on Moodle. Now, the reason that's interesting is because it's not a top 50 programming language, but for the research that the technical architect Mael has done would suggest that it's perfect for this particular situation. And I think, Dai, you might be interested in the fact that a lot of Elixir developers come into Elixir through Erlang or Erlang. I don't know how you say that.
All right, okay. Ruby on Rails. Okay. This is interesting. It's Ruby-like syntax.
Mm. And I asked, because I said, look, Mael, it's fine going with this, and this is why you've been hired, but we need to document all the decisions we make. And so if you scroll halfway down the job posting, it says, why the Elixir language? And he's written a whole thing about all the research he's done into it. He says, basically, federated social media apps are heavily event-driven, and Elixir's programming model is a great fit when building real-time IO-heavy applications. It also has a beautiful Ruby-like syntax and is so efficient, you can use a simple Raspberry Pi as a web server, which is pretty cool. So we're using Elixir to do the back-end development, and then we're going to be using React on the front-end, which is a JavaScript framework. And the reason for that is because it makes it very easy to use the same kind of code to do the web app as it does to do the native app for Android and iOS.
Cool. Well, get your applications in, everyone.
Absolutely.
Yes, where's the deadline?
It's a rolling deadline, so I want to hire someone as soon as possible. The advert went out while I was still away because Mail wants to act quickly. But certainly by the end of the month, I want to have made an offer to someone. So the next week or so. Right. So while I've been away, I took with me, I've got a OnePlus 5, as you know, and I decided that I could have taken all the apps off my OnePlus 5. But I decided, instead of having all that hassle when I got back, I decided to just take my OnePlus 1. I just wiped it and installed the minimum amount of apps I needed. And I just took that and swapped my SIM card over. And that was a useful experience, apart from the fact that the battery is not so good on my old phone. But it didn't mean that I didn't look at anything work-related at all until I was flying home last night. So that was it was a perfect break, really.
Oh, cool. That's a good idea, actually. I tend to use my phone a lot when I go away, and it's different because you're having a sort of family holiday, whereas I don't do that. So I ended up reading a book on my phone, for example, things like that, which is cool. All good.
Well, you've put a link in here, just to put things out of order a bit, about setting up Android without Google, and maybe we can go there first. I'm just going to put a link in to Lineage OS for MicroG. Now, I think I've mentioned this in passing.
You mentioned this when I was in Idaho, yeah.
Yeah. So I'd put this on my tablet already, but I put it on my OnePlus One. So Lineage OS is like a pure version of Android, like the open source version of Android. And MicroG, for those who can remember, is a way in which you can kind of spoof Google Play services such that apps work. And so I really tried to kind of not use Google stuff while I was away. So I'll not bore with all the details in terms of how I set up my calendar and did all that kind of stuff. But I did use different mapping software because I think we get so used to Google Maps or Apple Maps that we forget that there's all different kinds of mapping software. I don't know if you remember, Nokia used to have something called Here, which they used on their devices.
No,
that's now been spun out as a separate company. And there's an app which is literally called Here We Go. And it's surprisingly good, actually. I was pretty impressed by it. So I didn't have Google Apps or Google Maps on my phone. And I used that. And there were some times where Hannah was using Google Maps on her phone or Apple Maps on her iPhone. And the Here Maps were better.
Oh, really?
Yeah, just like better routes towards places or a bit more detail in certain places, that kind of thing.
Well, it makes sense that those companies are coding for an edge, you know? I'd have thought. There's another one as well, isn't there? I can't remember what it's called now. It's not the open source one. It's something else. Oh, it says it actually on the setup without Google. So if you want to set your Android phone up on this is a Gizmodo field guide. Mm-hmm. And if we find the map thing, it tells you getting your apps.
Or APK mirror? No.
No. It tells you actually the alternative to Google Maps. I think. So it's after that. Google Apps. Instead of Firefox, OneDrive, instead of Flickr, instead of Google Photos. MapQuest, it's called. MapQuest.
Okay.
Which I've never seen before, sort of thing.
Well, I've mentioned before that if you download F-Droid, which is an open source marketplace for apps, you're not going to get the kind of apps that you used to if you're just using a normal Android phone. But you can use something called Yalp, Y-A-L-P. But it's not the nicest interface. It just allows you to download the APK files directly from the Google Play Store anonymously.
Yeah.
But there's a new app which comes with Lineage for MicroG, Lineage OS for MicroG. And it's called Aurora Store. And it is really nice. It's got the material design interface and it looks really nice. So I basically had the best of both worlds. I had, you know, a completely open source phone, but I could download things like I had Airbnb on my phone. I had the Starling Bank app because I've switched to Starling Bank. I had BBC Sport, Guardian, all the kind of stuff I'd usually use, Path, etc. It was great.
They mention Lineage here, actually. It says, alternatively, you could go on go full-on anti-Google and install an entirely new version of Android, something like Lineage OS. You need a device that works with custom ROM and the patience and know-how to flash it. But you'll be left with a complete...
See, every time it says this, I mean, if you're writing an article for a general audience, it makes sense that you have to kind of flag up the fact that it's not your usual kind of install an app kind of thing. But flashing a ROM onto a phone is not that hard at all. You're literally following instructions that people have written down. Literally.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. But you do have to establish that your device will work with a custom ROM. But once that's done, you're kind of good to go.
And if you've never used a command line before, I would say, I don't know about your experience, Dai, but even if you've never used a command line, if you can read something off a screen and type it into a box or even copy and paste it, then you can do it. It's really easy.
It's true. That's absolutely correct. Cool. Okay. So it'd be quite interesting. I haven't done this yet on my phone. Now I have a mixed opinion about this, as I do about most things in the world, to be fair. I want my phone to do the very best stuff that it can do for me. And so sacrificing, like you just said, sacrificing some of the functionality or indeed some of the aesthetics in a way, cosmetics of an app, convenience of using it, is not necessarily what I want to do. I kind of want, I think phones are still, and you know, our transition towards living in a digital world is still, we are still in transition, and I kind of want to get the best out of it as you can go, and also see the damage that things are doing as you go as well.
I think that's fair enough, and I'm not planning to do this for my OnePlus 5 anytime soon. I have done it on this phone before, but as I think I've also mentioned to you before, Dai, that because there's two cameras on the OnePlus 5, the Lineage OS only accesses one of them, which kind of negates the point of having like a dual camera setup. And also because, as you say, you want the convenience of things working. It connects to my smartwatch, which I didn't wear on holiday either. I've almost got a ritual now of changing watches when I go on holiday or when I prepare to go on holiday and putting that watch on. It's one of those like £6 Casio watches that you wore when you were 8. It's like one of those watches that does the very basic functionality. When I put that watch on, I'm in totally in holiday mode straight away.
Yeah, I know. I remember going on holiday with my dad, and I'm sure I was probably the same, but going on holiday with my father, he'd always take a first week to chill the hell out. it would take a while. It was like a different man in the second week of a holiday. It really was. just really relaxed and soon to laugh, happy to see you, all that kind of thing. You know?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I tell you another thing we did, talking about things that kind of worked and didn't work. So one of the things that when you download Lineage OS without Google Play services is that some apps work, but not completely. So for example, if you download Duolingo, you can do all the Duolingo things, but you can't see the leaderboard if you're part of a club. Or, and this was the interesting one, in Zurich, there were electric scooters. I don't know if you've seen these electric scooters where you can press a button to go fast. You don't have to actually push your way along, but you could unlock them via an app. So you could download the app, put in your payment details, unlock the scooter via the app, and then off you bombing away, off you go.
Yeah. So doing that with the bikes quite a bit, I think.
Right. Exactly. That kind of thing. But the electric scooter was like instant acceleration, just really fun. And so we were bombing around the park in Zurich before it started raining.
That's pretty
and
cool.
The good thing about this was it was called Lime, and they had the bikes as well. But it worked, but you couldn't see, like the map bit didn't work. Yeah, so you get some strange behaviors like that, I would say as well.
Oh, okay, I see. That's interesting. Well, this brings me along to, so Google are releasing a new version of Android called Pi, P-I-E. And it's adding digital well-being controls. So have you ever used Quality Time or something similar?
Yeah, you talked to me about that one, like Bonsai, where you try and make the tree grow or whatever it's called.
No, it's different. So Quality Time is Quality Time tells you what apps you've been on, how many times you've opened your phone, how long you spent on your phone.
I haven't used that, no.
Okay, well, so it's an interesting sort of gathering of information that tells you what you've been doing. And in my experience, all it really tells me, I kind of know what I've been doing on my phone. But it tells, what I don't know is how many times I open it a day. And I was really shocked to find it's like 75 or something stupid like that. And so we're planning this year for our digital well-being program with the students, planning to use these apps and sort of increase awareness amongst the students of how what they actually spend their time on their phone doing, et cetera, et cetera. And making that part of the pastoral care in our school. And anyway, Android have cottoned onto this, and this gentleman called Andre Popescu is interviewed here on this BBC article and explains what it does, and it looks really, really impressive, really good. It's baked into the operating system now. Well, it will do when Pi comes out. So
okay,
it's kind of cool.
I'll have to have a look. Really, I see important. That it talks about grayscale mode. I remember there was a thing in the New York Times a few months ago, which we mentioned about changing your phone to grayscale to make it less enticing.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I think that's the right thing to do, I think. But mine doesn't go into grayscale mode, I don't think. I have a OnePlus, it doesn't go in there.
Oh, okay.
But I don't know, that might be something. I tried to do it once and I just didn't achieve it and didn't really care that much, so I stopped. But there we go.
Okay. Well, anyway. It's interesting that we're in this kind of world now where tech companies are admitting the fact that they have a material impact on our lives. Like I remember straight after the US general election and Brexit, where Mark Zuckerberg basically went public and said it's ridiculous to think that Facebook had any impact on the outcome of these, you know, these votes and elections. And now, of course, you know,
I know it, but it's also, you remember we talked when I was in Idaho, we talked about I can't remember the name of the lady working in the EU who fined Google $4.3 billion, yeah. I think it was, and or euros maybe, and that's all about this sort of thing. It's about you know, it's about time, but it's catching up with them. Do you know what I mean? This sort of, this dominance, this real, I mean, especially Google, this huge monopoly they have over so many different parts of your life, unless you're careful about what you're doing. But this is good to see, but they are going to be doing things like this so that the user, feels as though they are looking after you in some way and helping you to look after yourself and giving you the power. When really, if you think about how they make their money, this ain't it.
Well, like I said before, I use a blocker called Blockada. I don't know if you started using that.
B-L-O-A-D-A.
Well, since I installed it, it's blocked 63,372 requests, like tracking requests.
Oh, really? Oh, okay, well, maybe I'll get into that, because I do think that's the future as well, you know, is like ad blockers, for example. It's just something that does the job for you and you don't have to worry about it. And they're programmed, coded well enough to not interfere with your experience, as it were. So Blockada, maybe I'll give that a shot.
And there was a thing, I won't be able to find a link quickly, but it was talking about how, what was it? I saw it when I was away, it was in The Guardian, about Google tracks your location even when you think you've turned it off. So for example, you know, when you go into your Google settings and turn off location history and it keeps nagging you to turn it back on, even if you turn that off, there's another setting which doesn't look like location, but it's actually tracking you all the time, even if you think you've turned it off, which is a bit sneaky.
I think, I mean, yeah, so this is a sort of information that can only really be exposed by people who work for the company, then leaving the company and then and breaking their NDA. So I really think that more and more of that sort of thing is the case. And knowing technologies, I do, it's harder to turn something off than it is. It's like deleting pictures. It's harder to genuinely delete a picture than it is just to delete the link from a user to the picture. So I think if you actually turn your settings off, saying this is that and that is this, what you're actually saying please don't provide any evidence that you're tracking my behavior.
Right,
exactly. You're actually saying don't track my behavior, even though that's the illusion, because in tech, like, turning things off actually is quite difficult once you've got them turned on.
While I was away again, I came across something called Ethical OS, ethicalos.org. And it describes itself as being a guide to anticipating the future impact of today's technology, or how not to regret the things that you build. And it talks about, you know, if you're building an app or a platform or whatever it is, you can't think of everything in advance, but you can try and reduce the amount of harm that you could possibly create. And it talks about 8 risk zones. I don't know if you saw this, it was on Hacker News.
No, I didn't see this, but I really like the idea.
So just going through them quickly, perhaps we can take it in turns. The first one is risk zone 1 is truth, disinformation, and propaganda.
Risk zone 2, addiction and the dopamine economy.
Risk zone 3 is economic and asset inequalities.
Risk zone 4, machine ethics and algorithmic biases.
Risk zone 5, surveillance state.
Risk zone 6, data control and monetization.
Risk zone 7 is implicit trust and user understanding.
Risk zone 8, hateful and criminal actors.
So, I mean, loads of stuff that we talk about on this podcast is about, you know, security and privacy and like digital literacies and algorithms and people getting addicted to stuff and this surveillance state. And all of this is covered in this Ethical OS framework. And it's like supported by some people who have influence, like the Omidyar Network in Silicon Valley and Institute for the Future. So I want to weave this into the work that we're doing with MoodleNet, just to make sure that, for example, we're not making it so it's a really addictive app, which people, you know, can't put down. And it's not providing the means whereby I don't know, like it's got some kind of face detection thing, which becomes another arm of state surveillance or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a really nice thing that all technologists should be aware of. And also, as educators, we should be, you know, telling the future builders of applications and platforms and systems to be careful of these things as well.
Mm. I think it was, so things spring to mind. So quite often I think people who make things are usually quite intelligent and we'll be able to work out that what they're making could be used for bad in the world in some way. But there are also instances where that doesn't happen. So for example, the pull down to refresh on phone apps. We talked about that guy who made that not thinking for a minute. He just didn't have any space to put the refresh button. So he decided to do it by pulling down the feed. And now that's become a standard a feature of many apps across the tech world. And it's that sort of thing. So I definitely think it's worth thinking about. However, I'd argue that when people are out there trying to carve their niche in the world and make their way and make success of what they're doing, they're not necessarily, they might be disadvantaging themselves by looking, by having their ethical approach at the center of what it is that they're doing.
Oh, I fundamentally disagree with this. I'm reading at the moment Nassim Nicholas Taleb's book, Skin in the Game. Uh-huh. You've read some of his previous books, haven't you?
Uh-huh.
He talks about skin in the game, but he also talks about soul in the game as well, and how it's obvious when there are systems and platforms and approaches of people who haven't, like, they're not walking the talk and they've got nothing to lose by what is it, like. He's talking about the long term, and I've talked for years about the fact that in the long term, open source will win, because you know you can't run out of runway with open source. You can, someone else can take it over, etc. So I think the ethical, maybe just me being naive, but I think that the ethical solution will always win long term, because
I agree with you. However,
systems will create their own crises.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with that. I want to believe it, okay? But I think that much of what I see in the world, rather than in my life, I think, is about people getting theirs, basically. Some people are ethically aware and morally centered, and some people are not. And they're just like, this is mine, I earned it, it's mine, step away from the refrigerator kind of thing. And I think that's not, yeah, I mean, it's not just, that's in Asia as well. People are like that as well. So people do look after others sometimes, but usually when it suits them, I think, it is complementary to what they're doing. And I'd agree with you in what you're saying, in that in the long term, that is the path to success and prosperity in a very genuine way. But I think that people don't look that long term. They look medium to long term, but not for the good of the world long term, sort of thing, which is possibly a shame, but I think that is true.
It is, and I'm just trying to quickly find a couple of things. Dan Hon, who writes a newsletter called Things That Have Caught My Attention, which is wonderful, and he's an interesting guy, has some mental health issues, so sometimes takes extended breaks, and then will write extremely long newsletters for 7 days in a row. I'm not going to be able to find it very quickly, but he's basically talking about this, like software projects, technology projects, and how everyone's just doing what's best for their situation. But at some point we have to step back as a society, as a world, and say, like, who's going to take responsibility for this?
I heard this, I was listening to Richard Osman today. Do you know who he is? The guy off Pointless.
Yeah.
He's a very intelligent man, television producer, more than a presenter. He was saying, well, there were two things that were crazy in the world. And one of them was cars. And he believes that people in the future will look back and go, you really drove those huge pieces of metal around at high speeds towards each other?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? The things that will just seem very banal and abstract sort of thing and crazy. I can't remember what the other one was off the top of my head. Although I did, he did mention something else. He published a book, which I bought a copy of because I just was so impressed with it as a principle. And the copy of, where are we? We are there. And so I'll just put this in the show notes. The book is called The World Cup of Everything. Okay. And it has this fantastic, lots of ideas in it for family games or games with anyone really. So one of them was the World Cup of chocolate bars. So you buy 32 chocolate bars and everyone gets a vote. And you try the chocolate bars and they progress to the next round. And then you have a winner at the end, which is the world champion of chocolate bars. It's kind of awesome. Cool, isn't it? And you do that with all sorts of things. Anyway, I wanted to find out more, so I bought a copy of the book. I thought that would be quite entertaining.
I'll have to have a look. I found that quotation from Dan Hon. Let me just read it quickly. He says, and this is in amongst a whole rant, he says, "I've been banging this drum for quite a while, and my contribution is along these lines. We don't like hard problems, and it's easy to believe that technology, more specifically the stuff that Silicon Valley builds, like free networks that help connect the world at one end, and I don't know, juice machines on the other, is just good, and you don't need to think about it too much. But it turns out that technology doesn't exist in isolation. It exists in a human world with human constructs and stuff like economics and markets and, shock horror, capitalism. Someone, somewhere, is going to have to make a decision about whether the good, implicit, potentially underexamined, that such technology delivers is something that's incentivized by the wider environment. And if it isn't, then, well, Jack, Brin, and Pichai, their technology leaders, have to put their big boy boots on and decide what's more important for this particular decision, money or underlying values." You can see he's got quite a unique style, but I really like the way that he talks about, like, these people are just like big kids quite a lot of the time, making decisions that hopefully will please shareholders, but they're wielding this immense power. And I've talked before about how Twitter, one of the worst things about Twitter is being able to retweet something with a comment, because it's a really passive aggressive thing quite often, and that you can't do that on Mastodon, for example. Lots of interesting things. We've talked before about technology is all well and good, but you, and I would say this as a philosophy graduate, but like, the humanities is really important when it comes to technology, because you have to understand the way that humans work as well as the way that technology works.
And we would always champion on this podcast, both you and I are aligned in the idea that technology is really all about people more than machines.
Yeah.
And because, you know, bombs don't kill people, people do. And but I think it's, I think it's absolutely vital that people do this, but you're not going to get people talking ethically about things until they are, generally speaking, on top of their game and earning loads of money. That's the way it works. When people are trying to climb the ladder and get a foot in the door and make an edge and do the thing, they will use an ethical platform to launch their product if they think that is what's going to convince the consumers to consume.
How come we're seeing a massive rise in like vegetarianism and veganism then?
For exactly the same reasons, there is nothing to be gained by eating loads of meat. It's only bad for you, for the world, blah, 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 blah.
But it's not bad for you at the time that you eat it, though, is it?
I disagree. It's tasty
at the time that you eat it, surely.
Well, it's tasty when it's in your mouth, but if you eat loads of it, then I do think it's probably bad for you. I do think that people, I kind of think when I was in America, I kind of thought I saw things for a little while, a little bit binary maybe, and that there were people who did stuff and people who ate. I hope I don't offend anyone by saying that, but that's not a fair thing to say, and I apologize actually, but I think that we eat too much meat. You know, when we were talking earlier about safety, this conversation when people make cars, they didn't make seatbelts, and seatbelts did not become law until many, many people had died in car accidents. It's something like that. It's kind of like you've got to, things need to evolve. We need to learn about them. And sometimes lessons are learned really, really hard.
Hmm. But yeah, I think the way that I'm going to be in severe danger of talking bollocks here. But if you think about how, I remember back in the 90s, how, you know, it was all hippies talking about Greenpeace and about eating less meat and carbon emissions. And it was so like, well, I'm not a hippie, so I'm not going to talk about that. And then there was like gay rights and all that kind of stuff. And all of a sudden things shifted. And this is another thing that Nassim Nicholas Taleb's talking about in Skin in the Game. He talks about the minority effect. And the example he gives is halal meat. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, and kosher food. So he says that in America, there's less than one tenth of 1% of people will only eat like kosher orange juice, for example, or whatever it is. But they still have a huge effect on the rest of the market, because for drinks manufacturers, it makes no sense. There's no economies of scale for them to produce two different versions of the same thing. So they just remove the additives, which would make it non-kosher. And it's the same with halal meat in lots of countries, although interestingly not the UK because of Islamophobia, etc. But kind of halal meat, it just makes sense for everything to be halal, because then you don't, you know, non-halal eating meat people will eat halal meat, but not the other way around. And it's the same, I guess, with the kind of vegetarian and veganism as well. Meat eaters will eat vegetarian and vegan meals, but not vice versa. So you get this kind of disproportionate effect by the minority affecting the wider society. And I think it hopefully will be the same, hopefully, in terms of ethical technologies. So technology makers, when there's a big enough minority, are forced to provide ethical technology solutions, because people who believe strongly in ethical technology will not use non-ethical technologies, whereas people who don't care will still use ethical technologies, if that makes sense.
Mm. I do think it makes enormous sense. And I think that's an absolutely fair point. I think so without vegans or vegetarians existing as a thing, it's very unlikely that people would start to eat, you know, that thing wouldn't become so accessible. Someone said to me the other day, over the weekend, is that they cook vegan meals, because vegan meals are tasty now. They used to all just taste like crap, but now they started cooking vegan food. And I think that's a fair thing. I mean,
My wife said something to me ridiculous as we were flying home. I thought, my wife says lots of sensible things, but she said something which I thought was absolutely ridiculous. And that was, you not eating meat causes a bit of a problem in terms of options that we had this holiday. And that was blatantly untrue, because everywhere that we went had some kind of option that I could eat, obviously, because it's 2018.
Well, you say that. So I went to, Gilly and I were driving up to Lake Cascade, and we're stacking up on camping stuff before we went. I hadn't eaten, so I went to get a sandwich, and he said, oh yeah, no, I'll get one too. Brilliant. Okay. So I went to look, and he's a vegetarian, and I went to find him a sandwich. He eats fish as well. There wasn't one. There just was not. So I could have got him like a bowl of salad or something like that from the salad counter, but in the sandwich section, there was nothing without meat. Bizarre. There you go. And I said, look, I haven't got you anything. Do you want, I can get you a bowl of salad? No, you're right. Like, okay, because he was driving.
It didn't affect us anyway.
I think you're going to, I mean, you do find that. You go to other places in America, it's completely different. Obviously, if you're in San Francisco, you find it hard to get a
steak. Well, it's like Brighton in the UK. Like, you go to Brighton, it's the easiest place in the world to be a vegan. Mm. So we're talking about code, and we're talking about ethical choices for technology. And when I arrived back last night, the familiar shape of a book in a parcel was on the table. My parents had been in to feed the fish. And a book which I'd completely forgotten I'd pre-ordered was there. And I read some of it during my son's football practice tonight. And it's by Ellen Ullman, and it's called Life in Code, A Personal History of Technology. And this book is amazingly well written. It's She's a programmer. The book is written. It starts off in 1994 and was written at that time. So I've read 1994 and 1996. But these are timeless things about not just what it's like to be a programmer or to work in a tech environment, but also like what it's like to be human and the ways in which humans interact with each other and how society changes as well. And I think you'd find it really interesting. And I think, Dai, you'd probably end up pulling some sections of this out to use with your students to talk about, you know, we've talked before about not just the practice of code, but the kind of the culture of it as well. I think you'd find it really interesting.
I think you're right. It looks awesome. Mm. I'm going to get me a copy of that there book.
So it's only just come out in paperback, which is why I arrived. It arrived while I was away. It was very expensive in hardback, I seem to remember.
No, secondhand, it's still a tenner, like.
Mm-hmm. Just quickly following up on that then. One of the things we're doing with Macedon is making it decentralized, as I've talked about before. What that means in practice is that there's not just one instance of it. You don't just sign up to like Twitter or to Facebook, but you can sign up to an instance of Mastodon, or the one I'm going to talk about is PixelFed. And these decentralized networks mean that you can move between instances, you can have accounts on more than one instance, and they all work together and they federate together. So you can follow people, you know, if Dai's on one instance like Mastodon Social and I'm on social.coop, then we can follow each other no matter which instance we're on. And although right now it might seem like, why would people do that rather than everyone just being on the same thing? It totally is the future. And I'm not a betting man, but I'm willing to make a prediction to say that everyone will be using decentralized networks in the future because it's much more resilient. And as we balkanize the kind of social web, that's just the way that things are going to be. Mm-hmm. So while I was on holiday, I wasn't posting to social networks like Twitter and Mastodon. But what I did do was I noticed that my wife had signed up to Instagram. And the reason she'd done that was because she wanted to keep up with some celebrity or some what someone was doing or whatever. And I was looking at the user interface for Instagram and I remembered that I'd signed up for something called PixelFed. And PixelFed, just like Mastodon, is like a decentralized Twitter with additional features. PixelFed is like that for Instagram. And it's still in kind of alpha state. So the way that Mastodon works is that Mastodon is the platform and then you install it and you have an instance of it. And so there's an instance of PixelFed called pixelfed.social. And if you go to pixelfed.social/DAJBelshaw, you can see a few photos from my holiday. And as far as I understand how Instagram works, it works a bit like Instagram, obviously not as fully featured, but you can like things, you can share stuff, you can follow people, etc. And so I'm very pleased to kind of be able to get some of the functionality and some of the interaction that you would usually get through Instagram, but on a decentralized kind of network. And so I've been experimenting with that recently. And you can see a photo of a Porsche that I took in the Porsche Museum. You can see a McLaren F1 that I randomly saw in Stuttgart. Some pictures of the trainers that we wore, one of the Airbnbs, etc. But yeah.
Okay. It's just great to see you all in shoes, but there we go. Okay. Cool. I use Instagram quite a lot, actually.
Okay.
And it's kind of, yeah, where I put my pictures. So this is quite interesting to me. You've got lots of hearts and things. That's really lovely. Oh, no, you haven't. Yes, you have.
That's not me.
These are your pictures. Some people have hearted you. 4 likes, it says.
Oh, okay.
Doesn't tell me who, though.
So all of these, I mean, even... Interestingly, I just mentioned in passing that there is a life hacker, I think today or yesterday, wrote a beginner's guide to Mastodon. And if life hacker are doing it to their huge audience, then it's obviously a thing. And the main developer of Mastodon is featured in Esquire magazine this month as well. This is something that has traction. Millions of people use Mastodon across different instances now. And even if you just decide to move because there are too many Nazis on Twitter or there's too much tracking or whatever the reason is, I feel like you can find your own little space of the federated web. And so I'm looking forward to this being more of a thing. And I feel like in the same way that in 2007, I was running workshops for the teachers at the school I was teaching at saying, Twitter's going to be a thing. I feel like instead of it being this service is going to be a thing. It's more like the decentralized web where you find your people and have conversations there on your instance, but that's federated amongst all the instances that you want to connect to. I feel like that's going to be the thing. Have you read Ender's Game or seen the film, Di?
Ender's Game, I can't remember.
In Ender's Game, I can't remember all the details of the story, but there was one particular bit for some reason that stuck with me. And at the start of the book, Ender, who goes on to, you know, he's a kid, he's like 10, 11 years old, I think. He goes on to like save the world, etc., because he has amazing gaming skills. But in the book, he's not allowed on the networks. And the networks are always referred to in plural. And they're very obviously some kind of sci-fi social networks. And he has to find a way of getting onto these networks. And it struck me when I was reading it that, yeah, of course the future is going to have lots of different networks for lots of different kinds of things, as opposed to having one worldwide network for everything. Of course that's going to be the case. So yeah, in case I haven't labored the point enough, I think the future is decentralization.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. And I think it's very similar to the ethical argument. I think these things are inevitably going to end up being the case, but I don't think that they are. I think they can take a long time to get there. I do think we are in a state of transition with technology. We always will be, obviously, but I think we are definitely in a state of transition at the moment, services are still new, people are still working them out, and it will take a generation for these things to pass through and then for us to start to really reflect on them and how it is that we want them. And I think defederated networks will become a big deal at some point.
Well, while we talk about things taking a while to bed in, a blog post that I've been waiting to land for about 2-3 months now finally got posted, not on the Mozilla blog, but on Mark Sermon's personal blog. Mark Sermon is the executive director of the Mozilla Foundation. And he wrote a post called An Update on Badges and Backpack. Now, however he wants to kind of write this, it's up to him. But basically, the situation is this. Mozilla badges was never really Mozilla badges. It was more like MacArthur badges, because the only work that Mozilla really did on badges was funded by the MacArthur Foundation. And as soon as that funding finished, then Mozilla was a good steward and made sure that, you know, that badges continued to be a thing. Set up the Badge Alliance along with the MacArthur Foundation and other people. That didn't quite pan out the way that it was supposed to. The stewardship of the Open Badges Standard was then handed over to IMS Global Learning Consortium in January 2017. Yep. And the Mozilla, in air quotes, backpack, where people, you know, the default badge instance, that was looked after by Digital Me, who are now a City and Guilds company. And I think it's fair to say that Digital Me didn't do an awesome job. They didn't do any new features on it. It was often problematic. It wasn't compatible with version 2 of the specification, et cetera, et cetera. And I think Mozilla have got to the stage where they've just decided to shut down the backpack, which is fair enough, because at the end of the day, the backpack was only supposed to be a reference implementation, and it was supposed to be a federated system, a bit like what we've been talking about. Mm. So if you're listening to this and you're thinking, well, hang on, I've got badges in there. What am I going to do now? Well, your badges are going to be transferred to the backpack created by Badger. Badger, as in B-A-D-G-R, is an open source system created by Concentric Sky. And I know Wayne Skipper, who's the CEO there, and Nate Otto, who was the executive director of the Badge Alliance, and they are fantastic and really know their stuff. So your badges are in a good home and one that is going to be developed and upgraded, etc. What it does mean, of course, is that if you're a competitor to Badger, or if for some reason you don't want to be pushing your issued badges, you know, let's say Moodle, for example, let's say that at the moment, if you earn a badge in Moodle, the place that you're encouraged to store that is in the Open Badges backpack. There's no problem because you'd be able to push that to your Badger backpack. But I think a lot of places might want to start developing their own Open Badges backpack and showcase, which should have happened years ago.
Mm. Cool. That sounds very positive.
I think so. And it's just a natural evolution. The reason I mention that is because right at the start of the blog post, Mark Sermon says, Innovative disruption takes time. It was more than 25 years from the time the first email message was sent to when email entered the mainstream of business and personal life in the 1990s. It was with that kind of disruption in mind that MacArthur and Mozilla set out to reinvent the way we recognize and credential learning. But it's a good point. Like I have said on this podcast and elsewhere that I expected open badges to take at least, like I expect to be 10 years to go to being mainstream. And the first test, the first project was 2011. So really we're still 3 years away from badges just being something which we accept as being a usual thing that everyone uses.
I think, I mean, that just goes back to what I was saying about taking a generation for these networks that we use at the moment to move along, you know what I mean? That's the thing, is that whereas the technology, the capability of technology actually increases at great speed, that society does not evolve in such a way.
Yeah.
Good stuff.
Okay, you put a couple links in here about hacking and reading on paper and screen.
Okay, yes. It's, the hacking article is lovely. So if ever you wanted to understand how hacking happens rather than what it is, but although it does explain what it is, this is a lovely article to do so. So the title of the article is My Terrifying Deep Dive into One of Russia's Largest Hacking Forums by Dylan Curran. And it's just a really lovely sort of insight into what hacking is going on. When people talk about Russian hackers, and as they have been doing in the last couple of years, to do with Brexit and the American presidential election, this is really, really helpful. I recommend reading the whole thing to just give an understanding of how it's happening and how the people who are doing it are getting up to it and discussing it in the background, sort of thing. They're using the dark web through Tor, and there's lots of different categories of hacking, for example, humor and hacking insecurity and carding, and which is stealing credit card details and whatever. Botnet, freaking is another thing, that's trying to break into somebody's security network. Brutus, which is brute force attack, password kick, killer, as it were. DDoS, SEO optimization, programming, web development, malware and exploits, etc., etc. So it's really interesting just to gain some insight into what this really means. So I do recommend. The forum has 5,000 active members, it says. It's just the tip of the iceberg. Every subforum is split into dozens of other subforums. To document everything here would take at least 6 months and be a full book. An interesting quote in it. It said, this is a quote in the forum, or when you attempt to register on the site, sorry. The word hacker is incorrectly used in the meaning of computer burglar by some journalists. We, hackers, refuse to accept such an interpretation of it and continue to imply the meaning of someone who likes to program and enjoy it.
Well, back in the day in Mozilla, when the whole WebMaker program, Mozilla really did try to recapture and refocus what the word hacker meant. I don't think it was very successful, to be fair, because hacker is just somebody who hacks things for fun and sometimes profit, not somebody like a cracker was the original
That's right.
term.
Yeah, like a safe cracker. Mm. Somebody breaks something open or unlocks something.
Hilariously, like when I saw that this was all in Russian, the Russian forum, I scrolled up to see who wrote this, and it's Dylan Curran. I thought, that doesn't sound very Russian. I wonder if he speaks Russian. Lo and behold, no, he doesn't. He's just been translating the entire thing through the Google Translate or something.
Yeah, but he's open about that in the article. Yeah. Sort of thing doesn't take away from what he's been saying. Although,
no, not at all. But just some of the funny things he says about like your grandfather's way of hacking, and it might have a bit more nuance in Russian than it does in English.
I think it may well. but it's interesting, isn't it? And this is also this idea of distributing chaos within the Western systems. It's part of the narrative of what this is doing, this sort of thing.
Okay, what's the other one?
Right, yes, that's it. So it's an interesting read. I do recommend going to read it. This is a fabulous, fabulous article from KQED. And it's called Digital Text is Changing How Kids Read, Just Not in the Way That You Think. And I really love this. Okay, so it's got a lot of Daniel Willingham in it, whose book I read, which is cited in this, the book, The Reading Mind, A Cognitive Approach to Understanding How the Mind Reads. I read that last summer. And in that Dylan has this idea, but you know, he looks very carefully, he's got two young children himself, and he looks very carefully at what the difference is about reading sort of from books, from paper books, and from digital screens, and that they're not the same thing. So that somebody who is exceptional at reading books will not necessarily be good at reading from screens, because there are so many more distractions that they have to contend with whilst they're reading. It's a whole different experience, and that's really, really important. So the idea that reading, screen-based reading behavior, you can deep read, as they call it, but it's actually easier to deep read in a book than it is on the screen, and you have to actually be quite disciplined to achieve this well. And so the article just talks about balance. It talks about doing one thing, and Dylan has this I think it's Dylan's quote, I'm not sure, this idea of dessert, which I call pudding. So if you offer watermelon or chocolate for pudding, a lot of people would choose chocolate because it's far more tempting, but people enjoy watermelon as a pudding. You know, it's tasty, it's nice. So if you offer it to your children, you have a thing, you know, they're going to say chocolate, but watermelon is always an acceptable pudding if you don't necessarily put chocolate on the cards. So the point being is that life is about balance, and that's what I really like about this article. It just encourages you to, because reading has actually increased with screens, because there are more words that people are consuming, although reading some, you know, Instagram feeds and such like is just not necessarily of great quality and that kind of thing. And it just looks all at it from different angles and doesn't pretend that it isn't a complicated subject. So that's a double negative. So it pretends. So it states that it's complicated. I just really enjoyed it.
Well, this is really interesting because it comes back to some work that I did for my thesis, and I've just been trying to find out why you've been talking there, because I think it's an interesting point about the difference between page and screen. So here's a book by Ilyana Snyder, which was published in 1998, so 20 years ago. And I cited this, I thought I'd cite this a lot in my actual thesis, but it turns out I didn't in the actual thesis itself. But if you go to dougbelshaw.com/old wiki and type in Snyder, S-N-Y-D-E-R, you can find all of my notes and quotations, of which there are lots, which mention her book, should I say. And the point, this, what I remember her saying in this book, it uses what we, you know, in the same way that information superhighway and surfing the web are kind of outdated terms. She talks about hypertext, and we don't really talk about hypertext very much because we're so used to lots of the text that we read on screen having links that we can take us elsewhere. But there was it wasn't a moral panic, but it was certainly some kind of wondering by academics and by parents and by other people 20 years ago about what is literacy going to look like when you can read a book in any order. What does that mean? What's going on there? She makes some really deep, important points in this, you know, referencing Pierre Bourdieu and other people about what a text is, what literacy is, what it means when you can both read and write the web. You know, prefacing Web 2.0, all that kind of stuff. I find all this stuff fascinating because it goes back. Remember ages ago, you showed that video of the baby trying to swipe a magazine?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, it's like that. And we're like, oh, isn't this cute? And oh, but actually it's a whole different world. And what Ilyana Snyder was talking about in 1998 is now what my kids are growing up with. And it's kind of delayed, you know, what academics are thinking about and what actually happens in the world. You know, there's a delay between the two. So I find this just fascinating stuff.
No, I think it really is superb, isn't it? So I have a lot of, no, I don't have a lot. There are people in my life who are resistant to technology, and they, you know, they won't have phones and things like that. And who work in the school, and my point to them is always, I understand your position and I don't object to it because it's your choice. However, you are a teacher in charge of children and you kind of have a responsibility to teach them in that, to prepare them for the world that is not your, of your making. And they are going to need to read in digital. They are going to need to be able to manage their phones. They're going to need to be able to curate their phones to get them to feed them what it is that they want in their lives, not the other way around, to be in charge of it. And that's my emphasis. And I think that's the reason I like this article, is because it agrees with me, oddly. Is that it's kind of saying you need to read in paper and you need to read in digital. But I think a lot of adults are the same in this regard. You know, people have a Kindle and they read books as well. And you like doing both at different times. You might like doing, I know that you like your, I think you like your novels in books, or is it the other way around?
Yeah, I like my nonfiction usually in e-reader, so I can quote it. Annoyingly, I left it on the British Airways flight last night, so I'm going to have to buy myself a new one. Hey, just what you were saying there in terms of liking both things, this is a quote from, so Ileana Snyder in 1998 quotes Berbules and Callister from 1996, 22 years ago, and this is what they say. Quote, technological determinists who predict the social consequences of hypertext tend to rely vulnerably on either a utopian or dystopian view of the future. But because hypertext can be used for all sorts of purposes, it can both liberate and constrain educational and social practices. It can be an enormously liberating innovation or a powerful system of ideological hegemony. End of quote.
Yes, and I think that's exactly it, is that hypertext is fantastic and yet it's not all at the same time, because it takes, so the deep read is a really important thing. The ability to deep read, the ability, so not having alternatives to go for. Something cited, an app cited in the article, which parents might be interested in. It's beyond my interest, I guess, but it's called Epic, which is an immersive reading app for tablets. And deliberately it takes all of the distractions away and kind of sets that all up for you and keeps you in the book. And that's one of the things, like you were just saying, is that if you don't have hypertext and you're just there with your book, it's you and it's reading in your current environment. And that's what you're doing. So you don't just slip off to do something else. Well, you might do. You might fall asleep. You might reread a sentence. Mm. You might, or whatever it might be, you know, your mind might drift away. But ultimately, it's just you and that one resource. And that's that. And I think it's
And I think we conflate something sometimes. So I've mentioned about Instagram and there's things like Pinterest, and it's just like the endless scrolling and liking and doing all that kind of stuff. I think that's fine, and but there can be something sometimes a bit problematic or destructive about that. And we conflate that with navigating hypertext. What do I mean by that? So there's huge value in doing deep work and things, but when you're reading someone else's work and you're just reading it and you're not really thinking critically about it, you're just imbibing what someone else thinks, you know, which could be propaganda, could be wrong, etc. But when you are, in some kind of nominal way at least, when you're interacting with a book in hypertext, then you're making choices and you're co-creating the text as well. So just going back to Snyder, she says, she defines hypertext. She says, a hypertext is constructed partly by the writers who create the links and partly by the reader who decides which threads to follow. Unlike printed texts, which generally compel readers to read in a linear fashion from left to right and from top to bottom of the page, hypertexts encourage readers to move from one text chunk to another rapidly and non-sequentially. Hypertext differs from printed text by offering readers multiple paths through a body of information. It allows them to make their own connections, incorporate their own links, and produce their own meanings. Hypertext consequently blurs the boundaries between readers and writers. These differences help support the view that the use of hypertext affects how we read and write, how we teach reading and writing, and how we define literacy practices. End of quote.
Yes, I think that's really important. Hypertext is really interesting in blog posts, isn't it? So when you read a blog post, do you ever click on the links that are in the post?
I do, and also I'm a bit sneaky sometimes as well. I often put a lot of links in my blog posts, as you know, especially my week notes. But sometimes on some blog posts, I will only put one link in there. Or if I put like three links in, they'll all be to the same place. because I want to make sure that that person who's reading it, if they click on any link, will go into the thing that I want them to go to. So let's say, for example, oh, I don't know, I'm writing a blog post and I want people to go to the MoodleNet page. The only link I'd put in there would be to MoodleNet. But yeah, I do click on links, but I often open them in new tabs.
Yeah, I think that's really important. I was just thinking that. So it's one of my things is that when I'm reading an article, I want the article to remain open, but I also want to click on a link whilst they're talking about the thing that the link is, rather than get to the end of the article and think, oh, I should go back and check up that and that, that and that and that. No, I'm not going to do that. It's just not natural behavior for me. So in this KQAD article, I just clicked on a link and it overwrote it in the same tab. Now I can press the back button, and go back into, and it will take me to the same place in the article because it's intelligent. I just thought that's sort of not there yet. I think I'd much rather see something different, like some sort of pop-out little window or something that is just really acknowledging the fact that I've gone there, but what I'm actually reading is the first article, and that's the thing I want to be anchored. And you can do it as sort of Android's quite good at it when you're reading things on your phone. So if I was reading your newsletter on a Sunday, for example, and I would be in my email and I would click a link to go and see what it was you were talking about at that moment, if I felt the urge, and it would open up. And if I just pushed the back button on my Android, it would flip back to the email, which is good. And that sort of thing. But often if you go down a rabbit hole, you move away, because quite often when you go to another article, you'll go to another article after that because you're following a line of inquiry that you have in your mind. And then you're going back and back and back, and it all gets a little bit lost. And so setting links to open in a new tab is really important, I think.
Well, I've got a book which I think you'll really enjoy then. It's called Breaking the Page, Transforming Books in the Reading Experience. It's by a guy called Peter Myers. The Kindle edition of this is £3.22, but if you search, you can find the preview version, which is almost as good. What happened was he wrote this preview book about how he thought that digital reading should change, and some kind of mock-ups and some examples and based on theory and practice. And then his work was basically co-opted by an organization who then took him on board to redesign their app. And the preview version is pretty good though. And he goes through kind of the history of reading and how qualitatively different reading on a digital device is, and hypertext and stuff, and gives some suggestions on what we can do. And I actually think that Amazon on Kindle, you know, occasionally I do read in the Kindle app, and I really like their X-ray feature. I found that X-ray feature really fantastic, in the way that you can skim and find bits of books easily and quote and highlight stuff. I don't like the way it's proprietary and it's kind of surveilling everything that you're reading all the time. But we can do better, and it has been 20 years since we started talking about this kind of stuff. So I think the time has come to do reading differently on digital devices than we do on dead tree books.
That looks really cool.
Okay. Just a couple of things before we finish. There's one article called What Happened When We Took a Week Off Slack, which I haven't read in much detail, but I thought might be useful because I came across it just before, about kind of ethical OS and using your device in a more intentional way that you were talking about before, Dan. But the thing that I really want to talk about is 16 personalities. So I watched, I don't often watch films these days because I like text better, but I did watch while I was on holiday a film called The Commuter with Liam Neeson in. It's basically like Taken, but on a train. Have you seen it?
I've not seen this, no.
Yeah, it's a fantastic film. And I'm not going to give away the plot, but towards the start of the film, a woman comes on the train, sits opposite this guy who's having a bad day, Liam Neeson, and basically starts a conversation. And during the conversation, she says that she's a psychiatrist and there's 16 different types of personalities, and it's her job to figure out what type of personality he is. Now, your ex-partner is a psychiatrist, so I thought you might find this interesting to talk about. And I looked up 16 personalities, and lo and behold, there's a website called 16personalities.com. And at 16personalities.com, you can do a test, which is around 100 questions. And out of it comes something like a Myers-Briggs kind of result. It's kind of a tweaked version of it. Now, every time I've ever done a Myers-Briggs test, I come out as INTJ. And it then kind of goes to your results and all this kind of stuff. And I was like, yeah, whatever. And of course, the first thing it says for me is, you're going to think this is a load of bollocks. Because you're the kind of person who's like 2% of the population who likes taking things apart just for the fun of it and putting things back together and always challenging the status quo and never being happy with the way things are. And I was like, oh, okay. And I read a bit more. And then there's all these 16 personality types, and it looks very nice. And I've got my kids to do it as well. But obviously, as kids, they can never answer the same question the same way twice. So their results are all over the place. But I predicted what it would be like for my wife. And I predicted that she would come out as defender, which is kind of teachers and a lot of teachers and nurses come out like this. You know, people who defend the family and the state and the status quo and that kind of thing. And she did come out like that as well. So I wondered if you'd done this kind of thing and what your opinion was of this kind of test.
I'm not sure. I think, so I mean, I find it problematic just because my own mind is possibly unable to be honest in answering the thing. So it's always trying to second guess and third guess and fourth guess why the question's being asked and what I should put. And then I have no idea really why I'm trying to, what I'm second guessing. Do you know what I mean? Because I don't know what the actual personalities are, other than the fact you just said them. But yeah, I could imagine. So I want to feel good about what it is, but I'm not sure what I would feel good at about being, sort of thing. I don't think do I want to be a defender? I don't know. What is the, you know, it says you feel superior to other people. Do I agree with this or do I disagree with it?
I know what you mean about second guessing things, but I don't feel like the questions were asked in such a way in which you could necessarily game it to be one of the 16 personality types. I'm not sure.
Well, no, and if you don't know what they are, but how do you answer that question? You feel superior to other people. Well, that's a complicated question. So I would strongly disagree with that because I would walk the earth in a way that I do not feel superior to other people. However, I'm subject to human flaws and I guess I do feel superior at times to other people. So how do you answer?
Well, you see, I'd have no problem just agreeing with that straight away. So it shows that we're different.
You see, I'm Piscean, yet another load of bollocks.
Well, I don't think it's like horoscopes, I have to say. But I was talking about this with someone else today, and I was saying how I don't think you should be tried to be overly precise about this, but there's certainly, remember when I was in Mandurah in just south of Perth on that Moodle leadership thing, we did something else which put you in a quadrant. Now, I'll never say, well, I am just that kind of person, but just give you a lens on, you know, self-examination and understanding what you're like and how others perceive you and how you might want to interact with others. And even if it just helps explain that there are lots of other different types of people in the world who approach the world in a different way. I was talking to my wife has always been the kind of person who doesn't like dirt and things being messy and all that kind of stuff. But she's almost got obsessed with hand gel on this holiday and making sure that we don't have dirty hands when we're going to eat or drink or whatever. So I've started calling her Health and Safety Hannah, which of course she loves.
I bet she does.
But it fitted in perfectly with the kind of defender approach which came out here. Anyway.
Well, I'm going to finish this after we finish recording the podcast and see what I get.
Okay. Well, if anyone's listening to this and decides to do the 16personalities.com test, do let us know by email, Twitter, whatever, decentralized networks, what you come out as, because we'd be interested, I think.
So what was about this Slack article? You jumped over the Slack article quite quickly.
I did, and I haven't read it in depth, but basically what it was a company who had decided, because I know that you're thinking about the whole digital detox stuff and everything at your school. But this is an article on Quartz at Work. And it's an organization who decided to take a week off Slack. They don't properly take a week off Slack because they haven't got any chat app. So they had three rules. you weren't allowed to use any shared or public rooms on Slack. Direct messages were okay because they don't use any other chat app. And there was an alerting channel to kind of like emergencies or like finding people or whatever it was. And they said it was only weeks and expect to have this huge impact. But actually, the impact it had was much more than they thought. And just some of the quotations from it, they said, not posting status updates like going on a lunch run or good morning was freeing. It feels a little like punching the clock when you do that. Someone else said the biggest con was that they felt more isolated. Even if there's nothing going on, seeing the chit chat is useful. And they used email a lot more. And basically they say that Slack can be a procrastination enabler. And even just that week has made them realize that some things. So let's just go through these quickly, maybe in alternative order. Here are some of the changes we've emphasized. Have you found that bit?
Yep.
So number one, we all agree that Slack is synchronous. If something is said there, you're not expected to scroll up.
Number two, we no longer do the hi/bye routine. It's nice, but encourages the feeling that you have to be there.
Number three, shut down Slack if you want to be heads down. We've always had this rule, but it's hard to maintain. We do our best to reinforce it and revisit.
Number four, Slack is not a place for critical alerting. If something is down or wrong, someone should be on call and get that directly.
And number five, the team is now more diligent with muting and turning off notifications. So I think it fits in really nicely with what you're doing at your school. And I know, for example, that when I came back, you know, Moodle uses Telegram, and I hadn't even looked at Telegram because I didn't have it installed on my phone while I was away. And I had, just as you expect, hundreds, if not thousands, of Telegram messages from group chats, etc. I looked through those in case there was any DMs that I didn't want to miss. But on the whole, I just marked them all as read and just said, well, I wasn't there, so I missed those. But I did go back through my emails, and I think it's horses for courses, isn't it? And like they say here, recognizing the fact that some things are just synchronous and ephemeral, and if something needs documenting or something needs following up, you do it in a different medium.
I think that's right. And I thought I've been looking at chat apps, and there's Microsoft Teams, so we could put Slack in, we could have Google's chat apps, although they notoriously keep changing them. And So my issue with this is, so we use email for internal communication between teachers and pupils and pupils and pupils and whatever, as well as communications home, as well as communications with external bodies. And what it is at the moment is that email is the one destination that you can pretty much know that everybody's going to be on. Now, I know that there's an argument for having my frustration. What I think we need to do is to use email better. And so we either take all internal communications off email and put them onto something else and have email as an external communications device or service and keep it a bit like that, a bit like this company is setting up. But one of the problems is that you'll just get lots of banter going on. People use email for banter already, and you just get lots of procrastination and people feeling like if they've dealt with their email, they've done their work. When actually their work is not their email.
It was really interesting. You know, we've talked before about like bullshit jobs and about people potentially working less in the future, all that kind of stuff. And you know, as you go around the UK or wherever you're based, if you listen to this, you see people using their phones. So when I was in Barcelona, I saw street cleaners stopping. Not because they were having a break necessarily, it didn't look like they were having a break, but, you know, checking their Instagram feed or whatever while they're working, or passport control in Stuttgart, somebody in between checking passports, obviously looking at their Facebook or whatever. And you think, well, what did people do before this? Is it replacing something, or is it just filling in the fact that there's not as much work as there used to be, or what's going on here?
I don't think it's replacing anything. I think it's something new, really. I'm sure people had things that they did instead before, possibly the crossword or whatever. But I don't think it's, or doodling. People used to talk about doodling a lot. They don't talk about it anymore because fewer people do it. I think that is a big deal. Although I do think, you know, when the discussions we've had about the working day being too long and that sort of thing, people keep themselves sane, I guess, and happy in the workplace by, you know, if I'm going along doing the streets and I'm checking Instagram out as we go, it kind of makes me happy, maybe. I don't know. It makes me happier in my work.
Well, it's energy levels as well. It's keeping your energy levels up in some kind of way. If you do have to, an 8-hour day, and, you know, we talked before about only being able to do like 4 hours of knowledge work or whatever, that you can actually get through the day. I shared a theory with my wife while we were on holiday. She said the same thing that lots of parents say, like, oh, haven't kids got lots of energy? And I was thinking about that for ages, and I thought, I'm not sure if they've got more energy. Maybe they just, there's not as many consequences if they completely burn out of all their energy. Like, if you're a kid, if you're a seven-year-old, like my seven-year-old daughter, and you burn through all of your energy and you've got no energy left, there's somebody to look after you, yeah, and, like, carry you home or whatever. If you do that as an adult, there's nobody to sort you out.
Yeah, yeah, I know. I think that well, that's it, isn't it? And that is what's going on, is that you have this, these generations are, you know, generation, as the generations of technology users shift up, as it were, which we're seeing now. So we, I think I talked about it last time, is, that more parents are playing video games with their children as a means of family time, you know, rather than watching the telly or something like that. And you can see how that might actually be really good, because it's much less passive than watching the television, depending on how you watch television. And so I don't know. It's definitely something that.
The point I wanted to make about Slack was that, you know, now that I have almost complete control over my day, I spend less time on social networks, I would say, because I don't need to fill in any time.
Yeah.
So.
I don't know. I think it's, I think things change over time and it will get better and better, and we learn more about this. And one of the things that's happening at the moment in society is that we're learning more about jobs. I mean, we're being asked constantly to reevaluate which jobs are going to be automated and robotized and whatever, which are enhanced by technology, and what is it that we'd really need human beings to do? And all of this universal income and that sort of thing, you're looking at this idea that people are going to be reclaiming time somehow, and ultimately technology is going to deliver on its great promise, which is it's going to make our lives easier, as in less work to do. It's going to save time in the workplace rather than cause suck time, which I think, you know, still technology is sucking up a lot of time for a lot of people. But I think that's going to get better and better as the generations pass, you know? So as Ben gets into the workplace, he's going to bring a whole different perspective and set of understanding to the table than you had, because you were unable, or even if you understood it, you weren't necessarily able to affect that change because others didn't.
No, it's true. It's true. And things change. And, you know, as you, it's the Douglas Adams thing of anything invented over 35, you know, feels like against the way the thing should be. And so I guess, yeah, it's a societal shift in some ways. And the biggest societal shift, I think, you could argue the fastest societal shift has been the move to smartphones. And we're still, as we've talked about with Ethical OS and all that kind of stuff, we're still figuring out what that means. And
yeah, I don't think the future is as bleak as people make out. I kind of trust society and us as groups of human beings to arrest our poor behavior and things that are trying to manipulate us. And the scary thing is with AI and all of that, machine learning, are we going to go too far, too fast? For human change to actually really understand it. You need to move, you need to be moving on, but you need to do it with a set of reins on the horse, you know, so you can have some control over it and not go too far and break the world.
Mm. Well, one last thing that I've just remembered that I should share is that someone who I used to work with at Mozilla, Michelle Thorne, she became a mother earlier this year, right at the start of the year, and I hadn't really checked in with what she'd been working on for ages. And when I was in Germany, because she lives in Germany, in Berlin, It just popped in my mind, I wonder what Michelle's doing. And I went on her Twitter account, which is Thornet. And she's got this thing which she's calling Activist in Residency in Motherhood. Now, it's an interesting blog post in its own right. But the thing which I find interesting is that she's created like her own syllabus for while she's taking maternity leave. And she's got all these books that she's listed about, like The Philosophy of Technology and Empire and Digital Colonialism, Capitalism and the Next Economy, Human Development and Critical Pedagogy, all these books that she wants to read. And so I just thought it was a really nice reading list, even if you can't get all of them, just of some of the things that some of them I'd heard of, some of them I hadn't heard of, just to finish off, given that I've already recommended some books on this podcast, some ones that someone else has suggested as well.
Oh, nice.
Some of them are in German, because she's, although she sounds American, she's lived in Germany her whole life.
Okay, interesting.
Good. Okay, so what are you up to for the next week? You go back, what, in a couple of weeks' time?
No, sooner than that. So I start on, what day is it? I start a week yesterday. So I start on Tuesday. I have induction with new teachers. So there's lots of setting up. We've got lots of work to do. And then I'm running sessions on the training day as well, which is on Thursday. We'll kick off after the weekend. So I'm spending this week making the most of the fact that the time is mine, as well as doing some work. So going out for a run and eating nice food, cooking and stuff. It's good.
Very good.
How about you?
Well, I had Monday and Tuesday off this week. Yesterday and Monday off on holiday. So I'm working Wednesday, Thursday, Friday this week. Now usually I do Monday to Thursday. Next week is a bank holiday in the UK or in England at least. So my contract is such that, as I think I mentioned to you before, Di, my contract is with Moodle is such that my bank holidays are included in my overall holiday entitlement. So I get more holiday, but it's included in the bank holiday. So I can choose whether or not to take them because I'm working for an Australian company. And usually I do take the bank holidays. But because the rest of my family are going down to Devon, I'm going to work that bank holiday, the 27th. And then I'm going to join them down. I'm going to fly down to Bristol and then join them in Devon. And my wife is going to Friends Fest, which is literally the studio from Friends is on tour and you can go around the set of Friends. And her sister is a huge fan and they're going around and doing that in Bristol. And then I'm going to spend some time in Devon next week. But yeah, well, I'm sure we'll record another episode before that.
Okay, we will indeed. Cool. Okay, well, you have a good week. Enjoy getting used to being in normal life again. Holiday, which is something I have to do, I guess.
Yeah. Good. Okay, well, thank you, everyone, for listening to episode 107, was it? And do get in touch if you decide to do that 16 personalities test, because we'll be interested. I want to know what Di comes out as, and... just a reminder that I came out as an architect. So see what you come out as.
I'd have to see the list of 12 first. And then should I go and try and... No, I'm not going to look at them. I'm just going to do it.
Okay. Cheers, everyone.
All right. Take care. Goodbye.
Well, I'm just going to sit at the dock of a bay, watching the tide roll away. Sitting on a dock of a bay, wasting time.